where we came from, where we've been. They're eternal questions that say a lot about where we're going as the human race. Welcome to Ancient Mysteries on the Air. I'm Jim Harold, and this is Ancient Mysteries on the Air. Welcome once again, and thank you for joining us. Now, on this program, you know, we've been doing the programs overall for, almost 10 years now as I record this in early June. And we often have talked in all of our shows and in this newest show about the mechanics of places like ancient Egypt. You know, how did they build the pyramids? Some people believe in ancient aliens, all of these different things. But a lot of times it focuses on the mechanical and the architecture and those types of things. Today we're going to take a look at the spiritual side and how it may or it does influence us according to our guest today. Our guest is Paul Boudreau, and he is interested in the spiritual connotations of places like ancient Egypt. He holds a master's degree in ancient myths and sites have captured his imagination and attention since childhood. As we struggle to understand the importance of, or he struggled to understand the importance of what was taught to him by fairy tales. He's been fortunate enough to travel the world and to personally experience many of man's highest creations, both ancient and modern. On-site exploration of Egyptian temples, tombs, and pyramids demonstrated in his mind the need for more detail and precision in how we look at ourselves and the world. And his recent book, along with Lloyd M. Dickey, is Awakening Higher Consciousness, Guidance from Ancient Egypt and Sumer. Paul Boudreau, welcome to the program today.
Thank you, Jim. Good morning.
So, let's start in regards to what got you interested in this. I was looking a little bit at your bio, and it sounds like you've worked in ecology as a career. So how do you make this jump? What piqued your interest about these ancient sites?
Well, it definitely started many, many years ago as a child. And listening to fairy tales and stories of the Bible and whatnot, and being struck with how crazy the stories were, right? You know, I mean, Genesis, naked people running around a garden with a talking snake. I knew that these myths had been protected and nurtured and cultured for, you know, thousands of years. Why such crazy stories come down to us after all this time? So as a young boy, I was struck with trying to understand, well, what's in it for me? Why were these protected by our civilization? Why are they still being told to us every day? In terms of the ecology part, Lloyd and I have worked together for many years as fisheries ecologists, and spent many hours cutting fish on the back of a fishing boat doing research, and this provided us with some downtime to talk about our personal interests. And Lloyd obviously was had the same reaction as I did to these myths and these stories in terms of he just couldn't trust the stories that were being told. So this kind of launched us on a multi-decade, probably a lifetime search of the myths to try to explore what's behind them and where they came from, and we applied our scientific training and experience to the task of, you know, coming up with hypotheses and doing research and finding information and again going back and testing. And we feel that we've been able to identify a number of common themes through ancient myths that really relate to us and ourselves today in our present day search for who we are and what we might be. They're not tales of long, long ago and far, far away. They're about me right now as I stand and talk to you.
Well, and that's the question, isn't it? I think the average person, maybe not even somebody listening to this, but the average person who's just going about their life and so forth, they think this is thousands of years ago. These are ancient tales. Some people, for example, you talked about Genesis. Some people take that literally. Some people think it's a fairy tale. Mm-hmm. However, I think more people probably think, and not just talking about that, but all of these different myths and all of these different tales from days of yore, Gilgamesh and things like that. Mm-hmm. People think, well, those are just morality tales. Those are things that don't relate to my wife. So you, life, or my wife. So you asked the question earlier that you said, what's in it for me? So what's in it for them? I mean, why do these stories relate to us today?
Well, as an example of the kind of levels that we explore in the book in terms of the myths, we explicitly try to look at stories from a number of different levels, and the literal, the figurative, the esoteric, and we found that absolutely every myth can and probably should be looked at from all of these levels. And by looking at them from these different levels, one can tease out more information, more lessons for me. A simple example I talk about is the wolf in Red Riding Hood. I think everybody knows the Red Riding Hood story, and a wolf is a wolf, long, hairy beast with long teeth, and it's easy to look at the wolf literally. But with a little reflection, it's also obvious that we use the term wolf as someone who could be leading you down the wrong path, someone who's a bad influence. And at higher levels, one can easily see that the story has to do with, the process, the role of the wolf in Red Riding Hood's development. It's unfortunate that Granny had to get eaten, but, the end of the story is Red Riding Hood meets the hunter and they go off to a different life. So these different levels are very important, and I think every good myth has all those levels. I mean, they have to entertain us. They have to engage us, as well as providing possibly higher information about ourselves. And the challenge for me is to bring myself to these myths, to try to map the story to myself and what my life experiences are and what I'm trying to do in my present life.
Were these ancient cultures, like Egypt, were they plugged into something that somehow we've become disconnected to from the years? Did they have some ancient spiritual wisdom, or again, some kind of access, direct access, that somehow we've gotten disconnected from over the years?
As a biologist, ecologist, the Egyptians and the Sumerians are writing 5,000 years ago. As a biologist, ecologist, 5,000 years isn't a long time evolutionary, just from our biology. So my own personal belief is that, in fact, we're not that different. As people, as people with aspirations, as people, that are trying to find themselves. They definitely had a different civilization and culture. I mean, they had different tools for which to remind themselves as to what their goals were. It's hard to say. I believe I have met people in present-day world that I appreciate had higher consciousness than I usually tap into. I believe that has existed throughout our civilization. Obviously, I think this is an important task, and we should be using all tools we possibly can to investigate this. And sitting in the King's Chamber in the Great Pyramid of Egypt is an incredible experience.
Sure.
Some Egyptians would have experienced. As part of their initiation. So hard to say. I can only speak of myself, but I like to think that we're the same as the Egyptians, with the same challenges and the same efforts that are required. I don't think awakening higher consciousness is an easy thing at all. So it takes effort, and maybe it's not for everyone.
In terms of this book, Awakening Higher Consciousness, Guidance from Ancient Egypt and Sumer, what questions did you ask? Which questions were you seeking to get answered throughout this work?
The main one is to challenge the oftentimes common view that ancient myths, Gilgamesh, the pyramid text from Egypt, that they were primitive, that they were, fairy tales. And the key question Lloyd and I were asking was, is that true? Are they just unrelated to anything I live today? And by exploring the original texts and actually tried to look at a number of different interpretations, we believe we found many pieces of language in these ancient texts that describes me as I live. You know, one of the myths we talk about in our book is the netherworld, the Egyptians called it the Duat or Duat. And it was written about by both the Sumerians and the Egyptians. And I can't imagine a better description of what I go through as I try to connect with my real being, other than these journeys that the Sumerians and Egyptians write about, of a journey through the Duat. You know, in both cases, we talk in the book about, you know, you have to be prepared, you have to have the right garments, you have to have the right memory and training, and then one's plunged into this other world and you're challenged and you have to meet these challenges, and at the end of the journey, one comes up into a different world, or into a world as a different being. And so it connected with something that we Lloyd and I both experienced in terms of our own lives. So to find that connection is critical to our work. And in the early chapters of the book, we implore our readers to engage in this process of bringing themselves to the myth. These aren't something that you read to relax as you go to sleep. These are something that require a part of you to be listening and applying to yourself. So that was the main question: is, you know, are they more than just spells and myths? And for us, they became very powerful over our time of studies.
Well, it all starts with literally the creation myth. And I want to be careful when we say myth. I don't think that you're necessarily suggesting that something isn't true or doesn't have a seed of truth. That's just the terminology that you're using. But right. when you talk about these stories, at the beginning is the creation story. Now, what were the differences and the similarities to the Egyptian and the Sumerian creation stories? And again, what are your thoughts on them? Because a talking snake, pretty hard maybe to believe in some cases.
Definitely. I haven't met a talking snake yet, so it's still speculative that they exist. In terms of creation, all of the creation myths focus on this initial movement from the void, from the undifferentiated waters, to recognition of opposites, recognition of different sides, be it heaven, earth, land, water, you know, those kind of things. And so when we read the creation myths, we see them as describing ourselves as the void. So right now, or for most of my life, I'm a void. I'm just this undifferentiated mass that goes on eating, walking, talking, sleeping. But in my life, I've had a few instances where I woke up to see that there was more than just that undifferentiated void. There was me, and I was there. One of my earliest memories that I'll share has to do as a very small child at Christmas, with my nose pressed to the window on Christmas Eve, and seeing Santa Claus walk down the street. And I can see now that it was an emotionally charged moment to see Santa Claus when I wasn't in bed. And so my all my Christmas presents flashed before my eyes. But at that moment, I was there, and it still sticks with me as a real, you know, start to my process to say that, where was I before? And as I grew, people sort of challenged that I could even experience that as a young child. So that void, just having the phrase and having seeing the descriptions of creation myths from the Sumerian and Egyptian and Hebrew lineages helps solidify that, yes, that was true, it did happen, and that there was more for me to see in myself. And having that in front of me really helps me in my journey to say that, oh yeah, okay, there's more for me to see, and these myths are pointing me in the right direction.
The question of supernatural abilities, I think that's the thing that maybe makes some of these stories all the more incredible. You know, and then I'll use biblical things because I'm more familiar with that. But for example, sure. David and Goliath. Well, people don't see giants walking around every day, or a talking snake, or in other cultures, these supernatural capabilities. Now, did you find any evidence that any kind of these supernatural tales or supernatural attributes found in these stories actually mapped to reality, that there actually were giants, or there actually was a talking snake, or what? Fill in the blank.
You're getting beyond my expertise. But there are many strange things in the world, and as an ecologist working on the back of a fishing boat, I've seen, you know, organisms that, you know, are mind-blowing. To me, supernatural, to me, there's nothing more supernatural than waking up in the moment, and I still look upon it as a personal experience. And maybe there were giants, maybe there were talking snakes, but that doesn't help me progress in my own development. But to equate those David and Goliath stories, to the urging of my soul to try to combat this giant of the world around me, would be more my approach to these kind of tales. There are fast runners that I can never match. The human capacity for achievement is incredible, and we still have a lot to learn about ourselves as humans and where we've come from. You're probably aware of the recent research on the Göbekli Tepe in
Yes.
Turkey.
Yes, of course.
The most fascinating thing about that site, what I understand about that site for me, is it was built by hunter-gatherers. Now, I always bought into this. Maybe it's a myth, this line of thought that we needed civilization and agriculture and progress.
Right. Not a bunch of nomads just kind of living off the land.
Yeah. So to see real physical evidence from 10,000 years ago that what hunter-gatherers could do sort of shows me the kind of limits of what we still have to learn about ourselves. And although we live in a world with progress and civilization and settlements and agriculure, we have to accept that, you know, there may be other ways of living, and to be able to carve those megaliths as hunter-gatherers just goes contrary to my what I was taught as hunter-gatherers being, what was it, a poor and miserable life or something like that. And so to get back beyond the Greeks to Sumerian, Egyptian, you know, some of the things that Graham Hancock and Bouval and Schock are trying to investigate in terms of 10,000 years ago, I think there's a lot we still have to learn. And whether we find giants or talking snakes in that journey, I don't know. But to me, it's a fantastic time to be looking at our history and what we were as earlier humans and what we might have known at the beginning of our civilization. Another point, if you allow me.
Sure.
We have access now to an incredible amount of information, and obviously, information on the myths was critical to what Lloyd and I did. And for the Sumerian, there's an online site from Oxford University called the Electronic Textual Corpus of Sumerian Language (ETCSL). If any of your listeners want to Google, or there's the Pyramid Texts online, no spaces, Pyramid Texts online. And we are, we can see the original text and approach them in a real way. So we're able as individuals to participate in a way that we couldn't have, you know, a number of years ago, where you'd have to, you know, either go to the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris or go to Egypt to expose yourself to these things. We now are able to take our personal studies to the online material, and that's incredible. But we still don't really know how some of these megaliths were carved, and so maybe we've got some skills that weren't available 5,000, 10,000 years ago, but we may have missed a few things along the way as well.
One of the stories that you talk about in the book is the story of Gilgamesh, you know, this demigod of god of superhuman strength. He's a king. Again, sounds sounds pretty fantastic. What did you find about that story? Because certainly that's one my daughter was just studying it last year in school. It is fascinating. Excellent. And it'd be interesting to see the kind of things you found out about something like that. I mean, I know you can't give it to us all in a couple of minutes, but just some highlights, I guess.
Well, again, what we did was we looked at the Gilgamesh story and questioned whether, you know, it was describing me as a person. And what we developed was a model where yes, indeed, Gilgamesh is a demigod, but he's causing a lot of havoc as a demigod and not being very productive. And it's not until he gets paired with his wild animal nature in Enkidu that the pair, Gilgamesh and Enkidu, they do great things. They chop down a forest and they kill the bull of heaven. And for Lloyd and I, we see this as a story of the two sides of my own personality, or my own not personality, my own being, in terms of, you know, there's a godlike part in me, but I also has to recognize the animal side because, you know, I still get hungry, I still get angry, I still get crabby, and I have to work to balance the two. A key piece of the Gilgamesh story is at the end where Enkidu dies and Gilgamesh goes on to strive for immortality. And after, again, great efforts, he holds in his hand the flower of immortality. And just at that time that he's got the flower and he's, you know, his whole life is fulfilled, he lies down and goes to sleep. And to me, I love that part of the story because that's such a good description of me. In spite of my best efforts to be calm, be connected, to be balanced, most likely I'm going to lie down and fall asleep. So we look at it from more of a psychological point of view in terms of the need to balance our godlike sides with our animal sides. And Carl Jung, the psychologist, used the phrase enantiodromia, which is the reconciliation of opposites. And we look at Gilgamesh as exploring this reconciliation of opposites in terms of what can be done when the two parts are working together, what happens when they work independently of one another. So we see a lot more in it than just a hero story that is engaging and it's fun to read, but we see a lot more in it than just the literal.
In terms of how these can serve us, so to understand correctly, you feel, and let me know if I'm understanding correctly, you feel we can read and learn about these ancient stories, and then at least metaphorically, they have wisdom for us that can help us awaken our own higher consciousness. Is that the gist of it?
Absolutely, yeah. And certainly see our lower consciousness. So, we spend most of our life in our lower consciousness.
That's true.
To see both sides.
That's true. Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, is a good example of that, I think. Now, we read these stories. We learn about these stories. How do we turn that into action? How do we turn that into living a better life, being a better, kinder, more productive person?
The challenge is to be a person, to see our foibles right now, right in the moment. Not tomorrow, not 5 minutes from now, but we see our challenges as being present to the moment, and this is this is consistent with a number of different religious traditions. Western world has a bulk of these myths which have come down to us, and they are useful to us in terms of awakening us to what we are right now and trying to see our different sides. I don't anticipate that someday I'll awaken and walk on water. That I think is outside my scope. But while I, you know, drive the car, while I walk, while I, you know, enjoy a sunrise, those are all moments that I think the myths can help remind us of what's going on. Having a language is really critical, and one of the challenges of talking consciousness is we still don't have an easy to use language for discussing that with people. If I told you, you know, this morning I had a crisp apple on the back of the deck in the sunshine, you'd have a pretty good idea of what I was experiencing, even though we've never met.
Right.
But to say, well, last Wednesday there was a moment when I was awake, that doesn't convey the same meaning. So I think that 5,000 years ago, the Sumerians and Egyptians were struggling for a way to capture these moments of something higher, much like we are today. And language is as critical for me seeing the world as it is my talking to someone. Without language, everything becomes back to that void again, and you know, it's hard to nail it down. So it's kind of hard to see what's going on, give it a, you know, some structure to move away from the void, and then to try to integrate that into everyday life.
If people want to learn more about this journey, learn more about these ancient tales and how they can provide wisdom for our lives today, where would they go? I know you have a website and also the book.
Yeah, the book is Awakening Higher Consciousness, Guidance from Ancient Egypt and Sumer. It's published by Inner Traditions. It's been out for just a little over a month. And as good scientists, we've included many, many references in the book to the people that we've read and thought about and built on. So obviously the reference list in the book. But we've also got a lot of online resources. The website is ahico.com, A-W-H-I-C-O.com, the first two letters of Awakening Higher Consciousness. Listeners should, I invite them to do a Google search or a Bing search on A-W-H-I-C-O, and they'll be able to find the Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, whatnot. So if they have any questions, we'd love to hear from people. We've got all the social media outreach that allows people to contact us. On the website, we've got a few blog posts about symbolism in ancient Egypt and how the ancient Greeks learned much of what they talked about from the ancient Egyptians. So there's lots online.
Very good. We certainly appreciate it. The book is Awakening Higher Consciousness: Guidance from Ancient Egypt and Sumer. Paul Boudreau, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Jim.
And thank you for tuning in to Ancient Mysteries on the Air, and keep investigating those mysteries.